All right. Well, Johann Hari is the author of a New York Times best-selling book or two. He's the executive producer of an Oscar-nominated movie, also an 8-part TV series starring none other than Samuel L. Jackson. His books have been translated into 40 languages, and he's written about such interesting things that this isn't even his first time on this show. But he's been on many other shows. You've probably seen him on TV. If you don't follow him on social media, you're missing out on lots of fun too. His latest book is called The Magic Pill, which we'll talk about in a minute. His name is Johann Hari. It's a great pleasure to have you back, Johann. Nice to see you again. How are you?
I'm really good. I've had so much caffeine that it's possible this will be my last ever interview because I will die of a stroke while we're talking. But apart from that, I'm happy. I weirdly feel like whenever I talk to you, like I've slipped into a parallel universe. Because when I was 10 years old, my dad nearly moved to South Africa. He was he worked in hotels and he got offered a job in Johannesburg and he very nearly took it. So I always feel like when we talk, I'm seeing this weird alternate life I very nearly had, but never showed up.
One of the few countries in the world you'll find other guys called Johann. So
exactly, I'm well chuffed.
So look, you joked about how you might have a caffeine overdose, but you could also along the way discover that all this Ozempic you've been taking is responsible. They'll blame the Ozempic anyway if you die, so please don't.
It's true. If I die now, they'll be like, you see, we told you not to take it.
All right, so let's get straight into it because people over the world are talking about it. You call it magic pill, but effectively, there's always been this running gag that if the pharmaceutical industry ever came up with a way for people to just not be fat, that they would make so much money that they'd never need to do anything else. They wouldn't have to cure a single other disease and they wouldn't have to help humanity or develop vaccines that do or don't work for massive pandemics because this would be the moneymaker. After this, everything else would be immaterial. You obviously wrote this book because you are the sort of person who experiences and goes through things before you write about them. You're not just one of these people who takes other people's work and comments on it, which I've always appreciated, by the way. The last time we spoke, you were talking about the impact of technology on all of us. And I think that we're all starting to suffer the direct consequences you predicted in that book. But with Ozempic and all of its other, generic versions all over the world, it started becoming a thing here in South Africa. I started hearing about it probably 2 years ago. And then all my richest friends and all my famous friends, not that I have a lot of them, but they all were already on it by the time I found out about it. So in America, it's probably been going for a lot longer. How did you first hear about this and what got you so interested?
I remember the exact moment I learned about its existence. It was the winter of 2022. And it was that moment when the world was just kind of reopening again after, everything we've been through. And I got invited to a party for the first time in ages because there hadn't been any parties in years, right? And I thought, fuck it, I'm going to go. And in the Uber on the way there, I suddenly had this feeling of a little bit of self-consciousness because like so many people, I gained a shitload of weight during COVID. And I was quite fat at the start and I gained a load of weight during the pandemic. And I thought, this is going to be a bit awkward at this party. I'm not saying this just to name drop, it's relevant, was thrown by an Oscar-winning actor. And I thought, I'm going to be really fat with all these kind of, glam people. It's going to be a bit awkward. And then suddenly I thought, wait a minute, everyone I know gained weight during the pandemic. Actually, it's going to be really fascinating to see these, Hollywood types with a bit of podge on them. And I arrived and I started to walk around the party. And it was just really weird, Gareth, that it's not just that no one had gained weight. Everyone was gaunt. Everyone was visibly thinner. Like everyone looked like their own kind of Snapchat filter. Do you know what I mean? They were like clearer and cleaner and sharper than they had been before. And not just the actors, like the agents, the writers, everyone's kids and spouses. And I was like, what is going on? And I bumped into a friend of mine on the dance floor and I said to her, whoa, looks like everyone really did take up Pilates during lockdown. And she laughed at me. I didn't know sure why she was laughing. And she pulled up on her phone an image of an Ozempic pen. And it was, I guess, then and in the next few days that I learned, we now have had this staggering medical breakthrough. We now have a new kind of drug that works in a totally new way that produces really radical levels of weight loss. If you take Ozempic or Wegovy, you lose on average 15% of your body weight within a year. If you take Mounjaro, which is the next in this class of drugs, you lose on average 21% of your body weight in a year. And if you take the one that will be available next year, Triple G, you lose on average 24% of your body weight. And the moment I learned about this, I immediately felt two completely contradictory things. I thought, well, fuck, this could save my life, right? Mm-hmm. At that time, I was 44. That's the age my grandfather was when he died of a heart attack. Loads of the men in my family get fat and die of heart disease. My dad had terrible heart problems. My uncle died of a heart attack. I had been obese most of my adult life. And I thought, wow, if there really is a drug that can reverse obesity, that's going to be a fucking big deal, right? We know that obesity causes over 200 known conditions or makes them significantly worse. And it's basically everything we fear, from dementia to stroke, you know, or mm-hmm. down the list. But at the same time, I also thought, wait a minute, this sounds way too good to be true, right?
Yeah.
Is there really such a thing as a free lunch here? So to get right. to the bottom of this, I went on this big journey all over the world, from Iceland to Minneapolis to Okinawa in the south of Japan. I interviewed the leading experts in the world, the biggest defenders of the drugs, the biggest critics of the drugs, people affected by these drugs in different ways. I took the drugs myself for more than a year, and I really tried to get the bottom of what this staggering medical breakthrough is going to mean for all of us.
So you didn't do what a fat bastard would do, is just stay at home, eat, and take Ozempic.
Well, that's the weird thing about it, right? So some people hear it and they think, oh, is there some magical way it makes you lose weight so you can just sort of, you know, pig out but still be thin? That's not how it works. The way it works is pretty simple. If you ate something now, Gareth, doesn't matter what it is, after a little while, once you'd eaten enough, your pancreas will produce a hormone called GLP-1. And GLP-1 is basically your body's signals going, hey, you fat bastard, stop, right? It's the brakes. It's going, you've had enough now, Gareth. But natural GLP-1 only sticks around in your system for a couple of minutes and then it's washed away. What these drugs do is they inject you with an artificial copy of GLP-1 that, instead of sticking around for, you know, a couple of minutes, sticks around in your system for a whole week, which has this really, it's very hard to describe how weird the effect is. First day, second day I was taking them, I woke up, I was lying in bed. And I woke up, I was kind of coming around, and for about 5 minutes I was lying there and I thought, oh, this is weird. I feel something. What is it that I'm feeling? And I couldn't place it. And then I realized I had woken up and I wasn't hungry. That had never happened to me before. I used to wake up with this kind of raging hunger. And I went to this cafe just up the road that I used to go to every morning when I was in London. And I ordered what I used to order every morning, which I'm embarrassed to say was a massive chicken sandwich with loads of mayo and chicken in it. And normally I would eat that and still want some crisps. And I had like three mouthfuls and I was just full, but I didn't want any more. It was really weird. And from that point on, that's basically how it felt. You feel incredibly full very fast, which, you know, means you eat dramatically less. I went from eating about 3,200 calories a day to eating about 1,800. I lost 42 pounds in a year. So it's not that you sort of take Ozempic, stay at home and still eat like you did before. You actually can't eat like you did before. You would vomit if you tried to overeat when you were on Ozempic. So it induces a very big behavioral change, which has, as the subtitle of the book says, extraordinary benefits and disturbing risks.
So I saw a video you posted just this week where you had a bucket of KFC in front of you and a huge soda. And it looked like the way that, unfortunately, I hasten and hesitate to say, but so many South Africans eat, and we've got a massive obesity problem in this country. Sure. But what you're talking about is a behavioral change that this drug helps you to enact. You did say as well that you think, you know, it's too good to be true. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Having gone through the experiences, and of course, we want people to read the book so that they can figure it out for themselves, and because you're careful about this and I'm careful about it, your experience does not mean everyone else will have the same experience.
Yeah.
What is the overall takeaway from this? And if there isn't a downside so far in your experience of it, are you still on it? Do you want to get back on it if you aren't? And are you worried that there are side effects that you haven't yet experienced that may be lingering in your future?
I did experience downsides. I think it's a really important question that you're asking. So when you approach these drugs, if you're obese or overweight, you've got to compare two sets of risks. The first are the risks of obesity. And I'm slightly embarrassed to say this. The thing that most surprised me in the research for the book was the thing I thought I had known since I was a little boy. I'm pretty sure if you'd asked me at any point since I was 5 years old, Johan, is being fat bad for you? I would have gone, yeah, really bad for you.
Yeah. Right.
I was, and I think we've really euphemized this in an attempt to be kind in a way that I think ultimately is not kind. Obesity is, on average, stunningly bad for your health. I'll give you an example of a small thing. I'm really embarrassed by how ignorant I was about this. So obviously I knew that if you become obese, you're much more likely to get type 2 diabetes.
Yes.
In fact, if you're obese when you're 18, you have a 70% chance of becoming obese in your lifetime. And I think I thought, all right, that's not a good thing. Obviously, you don't want to be diabetic. But as long as you've got good healthcare, if you're diabetic and you get insulin, you're like everyone else, right? So, you know, it's not that big a deal. That's not true at all. From looking at the best science, from interviewing doctors who treat diabetics, you know, diabetes knocks on average 15 years off your life. In developed countries, diabetes is the biggest preventable cause of blindness. More people in the US have to have a limb or extremity cut off because of diabetes than because they got shot. And you will have noticed a lot of Americans get fucking shot, right? In fact, diabetes is so bad for you that one of the leading doctors in Britain, Dr. Max Pemberton, said something to me that sounds unbelievably shocking when you first hear it. But when you look at the evidence, you totally see where he's coming from. He said to me, if you gave me a choice between becoming diabetic or becoming HIV positive, I would choose to become HIV positive every time. Because if you're HIV positive and you get medical treatment, you live as long as everyone else, right? That is not the case with diabetes, type 2 diabetes. It radically curtails your life and it makes it much more likely you'll have a horrific last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years of your life, blind, mutilated. Diabetes is no joke, right? And that is one of the 200 problems that is caused by obesity. So you've got to take all those risks, which are very real. Obviously, of course, they don't play out for everyone. Just like, you know, my mother smokes 70 cigarettes a day. She's alive and well and nearly 80. Of course, there are exceptions, but on average, it's really bad for your health. You've got to compare that to the risks of these drugs. And I go through in the book the 12 significant risks associated with these drugs, which are different to the kind of side effects. We can talk about the side effects as well, but I'm talking about risks, right? And some of the risks are pretty worrying, right? I'll give you an example of one. So when people talk about, when you talk to experts about safety of these drugs, they make a really important point. They say, actually, we know quite a lot about the medium-term safety of these drugs because type 2 diabetics have been taking these drugs for 18 years now. So in addition to having this effect on appetite, these drugs also stimulate the creation of insulin, which is, you know, what diabetics need. So, you know, 18 years is quite a long time. And I'm putting it a bit more crudely than the doctors would. But basically, if the drugs made you grow horns, the diabetics would have horns by now, right? and that's true. And that's a good and important point, and it should give us some confidence in the drugs. But some other scientists I interviewed said, well, hang on a minute. If we're going to base a lot of our confidence on the safety of these drugs on diabetics, let's take a deeper look at the diabetics. So, for example, there's a brilliant French scientist called Professor Jean-Luc Failly, who's the head of a department at the University Hospital in Montpellier. And he was asked by the French government to investigate the safety of these drugs for the French market. So what he did was he looked at lots of things, but he was particularly concerned when he looked at the animal studies on these drugs, because when you give these drugs to rats, they are way more likely to get thyroid cancer. He's like, oh shit, that's not good. So what he did was he looked at a huge database of diabetics in France who've been taking these drugs and compared them to diabetics in France who had not been taking these drugs but were otherwise pretty similar. And he calculated these drugs make you 50 to 75% more likely to get thyroid cancer. Now, it's important to say a couple of things. Firstly, that's disputed. Some other scientists disagree. Also, much more importantly, that doesn't mean if you take the drugs, you've got a 50 to 75% chance of getting thyroid cancer. If that was the case, no one would take them. What it means is whatever your thyroid cancer risk was at the start, if he's right, it goes up by 50 to 75%. Now, thyroid cancer is pretty rare. 1.2% of people get it. And the vast majority survive. Nonetheless, it's pretty fucking alarming, right? And previous diet drugs, you know, began with these small warnings and then it ended up being a bigger thing. But against that, a lot of other scientists said to me, well, even if he's right, you've got to compare that cancer risk from the drug from the cancer risk of being obese, right? Obesity is one of the biggest causes of cancer. This is really poorly understood. If you carry excess weight in your body, it doesn't just sit there. It's not inert. It sends signals throughout your body. And one of those signals is for your cells to divide more rapidly, which of course can cause cancer. So every stage, you've got to be weighing two competing levels of risk. And I hope what my book Magic Pill is in partly a guide so people can think about this in a very personalized way. Okay, which of these risks of obesity play out for me? Which of these risks for the drugs play out for me? Okay, what should the choice I make be?
You mentioned that HIV thing that doctor told you. And again, in South Africa, this is probably the most apposite comment that anyone could make about these or any other drugs, because, of course, we had this huge controversy not so long ago where our former president didn't want to give antiretroviral drugs out because either he thought it was too expensive or he didn't believe there was – maybe he really didn't believe there was a link between HIV and AIDS. But we had – eventually, we were rid of him, and the new dispensation started making these drugs available. And there are many, many millions of people in South Africa who are now alive because of antiretroviral drugs. Some of them take them to this day and always will. But if obesity is not one of the biggest killers in this country, I'd be surprised. Heart disease is right up there, and those two go together. So, you know, it's almost as if there's an undercurrent of an argument that will be made at some point that these drugs should also be provided to people by public healthcare systems. And who knows, they might one day be. At this point, it may just be, you know, for the wealthy and for the people who have cosmetic reasons for doing it. But I think perhaps there's a big health argument to be made for it in the long run. I'm also fascinated by the fact that you are doing this, but you're not a medical professional, and you've done it in such a brilliant way that ordinary people can understand it, which I think is massively important. And the medical people can follow it. And I'm sure it's been picked apart and you've been criticized for it too, because, oh, you don't have, you know, the arguments from authority. Oh, you're not qualified to talk about this. You've done an enormous amount of in-depth research with the people who are. Do you still get nonsense from people, especially in the medical establishment, who say this is not helpful, this is making our lives more difficult, or are they largely complimentary?
I mean, I've been really lucky. I don't think I've had any criticism from doctors or medical professionals. You know, one of my previous books was nominated for an award by the British Medical Association. I mean, I was trained in the social sciences at Cambridge University, so I know how to read scientific studies. So I'm very careful in my fact-checking process. I always go back to the experts, go, right, can I read this to you for the second time? I just want to make sure I've completely understood the best science on this. So I've been lucky like that. And the book's been praised by really prominent and famous doctors like Dr. Gabor Mate, who a lot of people listening will have heard of. Just think about what you were saying before that as well, Gareth, about Thabo and Mbeki. Funny enough, I thought a lot about, in an early draft, I actually wrote about Thabo and Mbeki in relation to this because you probably know, I don't think this really exists in South Africa, but you probably know that in the US, there's been this big and growing movement that denies that obesity causes health problems.
Oh, yeah, the body positivity thing. Yeah.
And to be fair to most people who are part of the body positivity movement, they don't say that, right? Most of them don't go that far. And I think it's very similar to what happened with Mbeki, actually. I think there's a really, really strong parallels there. I think you're right. I also think about something else you said, which is about providing it more broadly. You're totally right. So if we think about the US, for example, Professor Gerald Mand, who is, well, he designed the food label that's on all food that's sold in the US. He's now a professor at Harvard, said that, you know, it's calculated 680,000 Americans die every year as a result of obesity and food-related causes. That's, you know, that's almost 10 times the number of people who get shot, who die of being shot, right? It's staggering. Obesity is unbelievably bad for you. Yeah, the so, and I think South Africa is at this really interesting stage when it comes to obesity, having spent time in South Africa several times, many times, and, you know, we met last time in Joburg. So when I was researching my book, I wanted to figure out, how do these drugs work? What do they do? But I actually started with a much more basic question, right? Which is, why, how did we get to this point, right? 47% of Americans want to take these drugs. 70% of Americans are overweight or obese. Between the year I was, so the year I was born in Britain, 6% of British people were obese. It's now 27%, right? So there's this really interesting thing that has happened essentially in my, I think we're the same age, aren't we? I'm 45. How old are you, Gareth?
Yeah, 46.
Exactly. So we're almost exactly the same age. So this is wild to think about what's happened in our lifetime. So I would just urge everyone listening to this podcast or watching to just pause it for a second and Google something for me. Google photographs of beaches in the United States and Britain in 1979, the year me and Gareth were born, right? Just look at them for a minute and then come back, right? If you've looked at them, what you'll notice is something that seems really weird. Pretty much everyone in those pictures looks to us to be either skinny or jacked, right? And you look at it and go, that's weird. Where was everyone else on the beach that day? Was it like a hot person convention that day in Atlantic City or whatever? And then you look at the figures. That's what people look like in 1979. Between the year I was born and the year I turned 21, obesity doubled in the United States. And then in the next 20 years, severe obesity doubled again. So you basically have 300,000 years where obesity existed, but it was very, very rare, right? Vanishingly rare. Right. And then essentially in your lifetime and my lifetime, it has blown the fuck up. According to the World Health Organization, it's more than tripled globally. And we know why that happened, right? The science is pretty clear. This change happens everywhere that makes one change. And it happened later in South Africa than it happened in Britain and the US, which is why you're having a more delayed effect. This change happens everywhere where people move from eating a diet that mostly consists of fresh whole foods that they prepared on the day to eating a diet mostly of processed and ultra processed foods, which are foods that are built out of chemicals in factories in a process that isn't even called cooking. It's called manufacturing food. And it turns out this new kind of food affects our bodies in a totally different way. And there's loads of ways it does. And I go through them in the book, but I'll just give you an example, one experiment, if it's all right, that to me just nails what is done to us. I've nicknamed this experiment Cheesecake Park, not the official title. Very simple. Done by a brilliant scientist I interviewed called Dr. Paul Kenny, who's the head of neuroscience at Mount Sinai in New York. He got a load of rats and he raised them in a cage. And all they had to eat was the kind of natural, healthy foods that rats evolved to eat over thousands of years. And when that's all they had, the rats would eat when they were hungry and they would stop when they were full. They had some kind of natural wisdom that meant they were able to go, oh, I've had enough now. They never became fat. They never became obese. Then Professor Kenny introduced them to the American diet. He bought a load of Snickers bars. He fried up some bacon. He crucially bought a load of cheesecake. And he put it in the cage alongside the healthy food. And the rats went fucking crazy for the American diet. They would literally dive into the cheesecake and eat their way out and emerge just completely slicked with cheesecake, right? And they ate and ate and ate and ate. The way Dr. Kenny put it to me is within a couple of days, they were different animals. And within a few weeks, they were all quite seriously obese. Then Dr. Kenny tweaked it again. He took away the American food in a way it feels very cruel to me as a former KFC addict. And he left them with nothing but the healthy food they'd evolved to eat over thousands of years. And he was pretty sure he knew what would happen. They would eat more of the healthy food than they had before. And this would prove that junk food expands the number of calories you eat in a day. That is not what happened, Gareth. What happened was much weirder. Once they'd had the American diet and it was taken away, they refused to eat the healthy food at all. It was like they no longer recognized it as food. They would rather starve than eat it. It was only when they were literally starving and wasting away that they finally went back to eat it. Now, I would argue we are all living in a version of Cheesecake Park now. And South Africa has made that change much more recently. If you think about that change in Britain, basically happened. When I think about when I was a kid, within a half hour walk of where I grew up in a suburb of North London, there were no McDonald's, no KFC. Now, when by the time I was 10, there was like 10 fast food restaurants, right? So obviously it's a more recent change in South Africa for all sorts of reasons your listeners don't need me to tell them about. But yeah, so something about the food we're eating, and I go through the 7 scientific bits of evidence about why it is profoundly undermining our ability to ever feel full and to know when to stop eating.
Now that's fascinating. But what scares me about what you're telling me is that actually all of this has to do with self-control. Which is not surprising, because I have long suspected that this is the major part of what goes on here. And some people just seem to have more self-control than others. It's like, you know, some people go for a run every day and the rest of us don't. We prefer to lie in bed a little bit longer. But what have you learned about the kinds of things that are in our control and the kinds of things that are not from writing this book and going through the experiences? Many people will say, obesity isn't my fault. I can't help it. The fast food companies are to blame, or, you know, popular culture is to blame, or the ease and convenience of all of this is to blame. And then others will say, no, it is all me, but I'm still struggling. You know, I have this in my family. There's that old joke, you know, it runs in my family. No one runs in your family. That's why you're so fat. But but where do you draw the line? Having gone through this, because I've been very mean to fat people over the years. I've said terrible things about them. Sometimes it's motivated them. There was one woman called Fat Pat who wrote a book and got thin because she was tired of me being mean about fat people on the show, and she liked to listen. And she even mentioned me in the foreword of her book as being a kind of negative reinforcer in her life. But I've always said that if you can't take care of yourself, why should the public health system? Why should everybody else have to make extra space for you in an airplane? All of that stuff. Where is the line between self-control and those things that are actually beyond your control?
I think there's so many things what you just said that are really important to think about. So willpower is very real. Everyone listening has exercised willpower over something in their life, right? Willpower is definitely real. The people who say, oh, there's no role for willpower, they're wrong, right? But I think the best way to understand this, if you think about obesity or actually lots of things, there's 3 kinds of cause of obesity, right? And 3 kind of, which are all relevant to the way out of it. So the kind of fancy term for this is the biopsychosocial model, which sounds complicated, but it's actually very simple. The 3 kinds of cause are, there are biological causes. There are things like your genes. We all know some people who find it very easy to put on weight, and some people who can eat like pigs and never put on weight, right? And there are real biological changes that happen as you become obese that make it harder to go back. We can talk about them. So there's those biological causes. There are psychological causes. Willpower is a big part of that, but there are other psychological causes: how you feel about yourself, what motivates you, how much you want to comfort eat because your life is shit, whatever that might be. So psychological causes. And then there's social causes, how the environment affects you. Things like the food system, right? It's very different. How you eat in rural KwaZulu-Natal is very different to how you eat if you live like I used to, 2 blocks away from Times Square, right? So there's environmental factors. So they're all real, biopsychosocial, all real, all play out to some degree for everyone, and different levels for different people, obviously, right? What I think of as willpower, how we think about willpower in relation to that is willpower is one sliver of one part of that, right? It's one part of the psychological component of the biopsychosocial model. Definitely real, right? I've had times in my life where I exercise willpower and I lost weight in the short term. I exercise willpower every day on other things, right? I write 3 hours a day. I'm pretty disciplined about it. I put my phone in the case safe. I put Freedom, which is a safe that locks your phone away. We talked about it last time. I put Freedom on my laptop, which cuts me off from looking at the internet. That's an exercise of willpower, right? I could not do that, and I could fritter away half of those 3 hours looking at, you know, pictures of dogs on Instagram or whatever, right? But I don't do it because I use my willpower. Willpower is real. But when it comes to obesity, the way I think about willpower is it's a bit like an umbrella in a bad storm. If I give you an umbrella in a bad storm, some people, they're going to be able to use that umbrella and get to the other side of the street and stay dry. Good luck to them. I'm glad for them. But at the moment, the storm we have is so bad that for most people, it'll break the umbrella, right? And it is breaking the umbrella. There's no fat person in the world who hasn't been told, do you know, have you ever considered exercising willpower, right? The 051, right? So absolutely, if you are overweight or obese, the first recourse should be you should try to exercise willpower to restrict the number of calories that you consume and increase the number of calories you burn. That is really important. And for a significant number of people, it works. Actually, it's surprisingly small. If you look at the best research, I interviewed Professor Tracy Mann in Minneapolis about this, who's done the best research on it. It's about 15% of people for whom that personal willpower works in the longer term. In the short term, it works for vastly more people. For 3 to 6 months, most people lose weight on diets. But over 2 years, it's pretty small, right? It's not no one. One of my closest relatives has done exactly that, was hugely and disturbingly and dangerously overweight. And through calorie restriction alone, and a bit of exercise, but almost entirely calorie restriction, has literally halved his weight. Amazing. Couldn't be more proud of him. Incredible thing to see. But we shouldn't take outliers as the kind of model for everyone, right? That's why, in addition to talking about willpower, which we absolutely should do, and we should repudiate the people who say it's not real, we have to talk about all the other stuff, the environmental factors, how we can deal with that. I went to Japan, almost no obesity in Japan, literally almost no childhood obesity in Japan. That's not because they've got better willpower than us. That's because they design their society differently, although they might also have better willpower than us, to be fair. But that's not the biggest thing going on. And we've got to deal with the biological components, which is partly what brings us to these drugs, right?
You know, you talk about Japan being different, and I keep wondering what those environmental differences are and what they can be, because this is so complicated. I mean, if the answer was simple, we would have figured it out 20 years ago and we would have had less obesity. But it's not so simple. Does Ozempic, do these magic pills, these magic injections, do these help people to get to that answer quicker? And if that's the case, isn't it worth the risk just based on the fact that obesity is certain to kill you and the complications of being, especially if you're morbidly obese, those are just, there's no quick fix and no amount of pretending that you're going to run and stop eating will even get you over the starting line, let alone the finish line. Shouldn't we just be taking this?
So the way I think about these drugs, this is a slightly over the top way of describing it, but they're an incredibly powerful tool. And the analogy, the over-the-top analogy, is with fire, right? Fire is a fucking great tool if I use it to warm my house. It's a really bad tool if I use it to burn down your house, right? And these drugs are so powerful and such a massive breakthrough. The way one of the scientists put it to me is, we've discovered what regulates human appetite, right? It's gut hormones and simulating gut hormones. A mind-blowing breakthrough. An analyst for Barclays Bank said, if you want to understand how big an effect this is going to have on our society, you've got to compare it to the invention of the smartphone, right? Because 8 years from now, these are going to be a daily pill. They'll be a dollar a day. I would predict half the people in South Africa will be taking them. So you're totally right. When you think about fire, analogy to fire, there are huge numbers of people who, in my opinion, and I want to stress again, I'm not a doctor. People should talk to their doctors. But having interviewed the leading experts in the world and really deeply dived into the science, in my view, there are really significant numbers of people who, on balance, should be taking these drugs. And indeed, I believe these drugs may well be saving my life. If you take these drugs and you had a BMI higher than 27, which I did, it lowers your risk of a heart attack or stroke by 20% over 2 years. Staggering, right? given how many men in my family get heart attacks, might well save my life, right? There are other people who absolutely should not be taking these drugs. I am extremely worried about young girls with eating disorders who are getting hold of these drugs. We can go into that more. But I think you're right when you say, look, you started with severely obese people, and in a way, that's the easiest category for us to think about. So I think, for example, about a guy called Jeff Parker, who I interviewed. So Jeff is a super nice guy. He's a retired lighting engineer in San Francisco. And Jeff was hugely overweight, and he was finding it painful to walk. He had gout. He had, if I remember rightly, liver and kidney problems. He was swallowing fistfuls of pills every day. He tried all the diet plans there are and didn't work for him. And then he started to take Mounjaro, which is one of these new weight loss drugs. And he lost a staggering amount of weight. His doctor took him off almost all his pills. His gout went away. His kidney problems went away. Now he walks his dog over the Golden Gate Bridge every day. He said to me, I feel like I'm finally going to enjoy my retirement. In my view, Jeff took the right decision, right?
Yeah.
If you are severely obese, so if your BMI is higher than 35, there are really significant risks associated with these drugs. We've touched on some. I'm sure we'll talk about more. But in my view, and more importantly, in the view of most of the experts I spoke to, the risks of serious obesity are so great that they, if you can reverse it like Jeff did, and these drugs do reverse it, or massively reduce it to be precise, that for me outweighs the risks of drugs. Now, that's true for people who have a BMI higher than 35. If your BMI is lower than 27, so you're not obese or overweight, and there are BMI calculators online, people can figure this out very easily online, then I would say you definitely shouldn't take them because you're not overweight or obese. You're taking on all the risks of the drug for only an aesthetic benefit. And indeed, you'll probably make yourself super skinny, which may sound like a good thing if you're a woman, but actually brings with it is a different set of health risks, which can be quite serious as you get older. If right. your BMI is between 27 and 35, it's a much, frankly, much harder call. And I think you have to really go through the risks of both sides that I talk about in the book. I would add a couple of caveats to that. If you've got thyroid cancer in your family, even if you're severely obese, you might want to think carefully. And I would say you probably shouldn't. Also, if you're trying to get pregnant, so what we, or if you're even just at risk of getting pregnant, obviously not an issue I'm worried about, but if that happens to me, I'll get a bigger book deal than I've had before. My memoir of being the first man to get pregnant. But the... if you think getting pregnant, what we do know is that you when we give these drugs to rats, or the active component to rats, they're significantly more likely to have babies with birth deformities. Quite worried about that. So if you want to get pregnant, if you think you might even get pregnant by accident, I would say don't take it.
One of the other fascinating things that you go into in this book, and I've seen you talk about it in subsequent interviews, is the unforeseen consequences of what this may do to society and what it's doing in the market in America already. That, to me, is mind-blowing. The fast food industry, the clothing industry, the way people are using their time, their behavior, their lunch breaks, all of that stuff. Share some of that with us as a sort of a taster of what else you uncovered.
So true, you know. The book is called Magic Pill. There's three ways these drugs could be magic. The first is the most obvious. They could just solve the problem, right? I've got to tell you, Gareth, the days it feels like that. My whole life, I've massively overeaten. Now I inject myself once a week in the leg. I barely even feel it. It's like a little tiny scratch from an EpiPen. I don't overeat anymore. Mind-blowing. Feels like magic. Second way it could be magic is much more disturbing. It could be like a magic trick. It could be like, you know, a conjurer who shows you a card trick while picking your pocket. It could be that over time, the 12 significant risks associated with these drugs actually outweigh the benefits. I do not rule that out. Some of them that are could be quite bad in the long term. The third way, though, I actually think is the most obvious, is the actually most likely. You think about the stories of magic that we grew up with when we were kids, right? Think about Aladdin. Mm-hmm. You find the lamp, you rub it, the genie appears. He grants your wish and your wish comes true. but never quite in the way you expected, right? There's always some unseen, unpredictable effect that makes the whole story turn out very differently to how you thought it would. And I think we're already seeing that in some negative ways. Young girls with eating disorders, and like I said, I'm super worried about that. I think if we don't regulate these drugs much more tightly, we're going to just have a opioid-like death toll of young girls with eating disorders, some young boys, but it's mostly young girls with eating disorders who will kill themselves with these drugs. But also in the economy, I mean, there's just wild things happening with the economy. Jefferies Financial just did a report for the American Airlines saying they should prepare to spend a lot less money on jet fuel because it takes so much less jet fuel to fly much thinner people. Their jewelers all over LA have had a huge run on people who need to have their wedding bands refitted because their fingers have shrunk so much because they're all on Ozempic and they don't fit anymore. There's so many weird economic effects. Krispy Kreme stock tanked in October last year, which some analysts said was because of concerns that, you know, their customer base. I mean, the number of Krispy Kreme donuts I have not bought in the last year and 5 months alone must have tanked their fucking stock, right? So this is going to have, you know, like I say, Barclays bank analyst said it was going to be like the smartphone in terms of its implications. If you and me have been talking in whenever it was, I think it was April 2007 when Steve Jobs first unveiled the iPhone, we would not have been able to game out TikTok and DoorDash and Me Too and all these things that flowed from the invention of the smartphone. This is going to upend our lives in really dramatic ways. Weight is going to be under our control at the moment. Look, small numbers of rich people can get these drugs in South Africa at the moment. But like I say, soon it'll be a generic. It'll be very cheap. It'll be almost certainly be a pill. I mean, you can already get them as pills, but the pills will become more effective and as effective as the injections. This is beyond a game changer. If the 12 big risks don't turn out to be worse than we think, which they might.
Are you on it now?
Yeah. So I decided to stay on it for a very personal reason, which is when the trials came through about the massive reduction in heart attack risk. For me, it was just with someone with the heart disease risk in my family, it's a no-brainer, right? For me, that outweighs the long-term risks. But it's perfectly possible someone will discover this podcast 40 years from now and go, you fucking fool. You know, you thought it would outweigh the risk, but it doesn't. I'll give you an example of one of the risks. For me, the risk that obviously I'm not worried about getting pregnant or eating disorders or some of the other things that I warn about in the book. For me personally, there was one risk that did play out and another one that I'm worried might play out. So it's really weird, this one. The first 6 months I was taking the drugs, I was getting healthier. I was obviously getting healthier, right? I was getting what I wanted. I was losing a shitload of weight. You know, hot people were hitting on me, right? All sorts of good things were happening. But I actually didn't feel better emotionally. Actually, weirdly, I felt slightly worse. I don't want to overstate it. I feel terrible, but I felt quite muted. And some doctors have been warning, although again, this is disputed, that these drugs may be causing depression or even suicidal thoughts in some people. Now, it wasn't so bad for me, but I thought, well, maybe it's something going on here, right? Now, there's different theories about this. We know these drugs primarily don't work on your gut, but on your brain. You have GLP-1 receptors in your brain as well as your gut. And increasingly, from interviewing the cutting-edge neuroscientists, it's clear these drugs are primarily affecting your brain. We don't really know how, which is a bit disturbing, but one theory is they're dampening the reward system in your brain. One of the reasons why I choose a salad now over a Big Mac sometimes is because the Big Mac is less rewarding to me because my reward system is a little bit dampened, right? But I actually think for me, look, it's hard to tell from any individual anecdote, but I actually think for me and for most people, it was something much more basic. I had a real epiphany about this in Vegas. I spend a lot of time in Vegas, as you know, because I'm writing a book about a series of crimes that have been happening there. And I was there 7 months in, I think it was 7 months into writing the book, and I was researching the murder of someone that I knew and really loved. It was a very difficult thing. And I felt like shit, as you can imagine. And I went to this branch of KFC on West Sahara that I've been to a thousand times. And I ordered what I used to order every time I went there, and I would have ordered before I went to Ozempic. I ordered a bucket of fried chicken and had one of the chicken drumsticks. And I suddenly thought, oh, fuck, I can't eat this bucket of chicken, right? You can't overeat when you, when you're on these drugs. Imagine if I went up to you after you had a fucking massive Christmas dinner and I said, oh, great news, Gareth, I bought you a KFC bucket. You just, that's how you'd feel, right? That's how you feel on this episode, you'd be like, oh, take it away from me, right?
Right.
And I remember, it's funny, Colonel Sanders was on the wall and I felt like he was looking down at me going, mate, what happened to my best customer, right? But I realized in that moment, I remember thinking, I had very consciously felt as a voice in my mind, oh, you're just going to have to feel like shit now, right? And I realized, and there's a lot of wider evidence on this that I go through in the book, obviously, what these drugs do is they radically disrupt your underlying eating patterns. Now, that's a good thing, right? That's why you lose so much weight. But what that can do is bring to the surface some of the underlying emotional reasons why you eat all along. So I talk in the book about the five reasons why we eat. Only one of them is to sustain our bodies, right? The other four are psychological. And I realized, you know, we've talked about this before, but I grew up in an environment, a family, it was very violent, a lot of addiction, a lot of craziness. And I realized, I sort of had some awareness of this before. It wasn't like a blinding light epiphany, but I realized from when I was quite young, I actually think I ate mostly, I kind of stuffed myself to calm myself down, right? To sort of numb myself out a bit. And I couldn't do that when I was on Ozempic. I just couldn't. And I think that's why I was feeling worse for quite a long time. Now, it turned out to be a good thing for me because, you know, if you bring those things to the surface, you can deal with them in better ways. Obviously, better ways to deal with your psychological distress than Colonel Sanders, right? But that can be a bumpy and difficult process. The other one that I was worried about for myself, I mean, there's a few I was worried about for myself, but the other one I was worried about is the long-term effects. So we have no idea about the long-term effects of these drugs, right? And there's an analogy that one of the scientists brought up to me that was very alarming. It's a brilliant scientist called Dr. Greg Stanwood, who's at Florida State University. Now, I want to stress, he's broadly in favor of these drugs. He's, in fact, when I spoke to him, he's thinking of taking them himself. And he stressed he was raising this somewhat speculatively because by definition, we don't know. But he gave me an analogy that I think is worth thinking about. If you go back to the early 1960s, scientists started to give some patients antipsychotic drugs. And at the time, they judged that the benefits outweighed the risks. 40, 50 years down the line, it was discovered, if you take these drugs for a really long time, you're way more likely to get dementia. It's not that the doctors in the 60s were being negligent. You could know that, right? There was no way to know that that would happen, right? Because you had to have people take it for a really long time. Now, I'm not saying these drugs will give people dementia. There's absolutely no reason to believe that. All I'm saying is maybe there'll be some long-term effect that we have no idea about. But when I say that, I want it to be fair. I think a lot about something that a brilliant obesity specialist in New Orleans, Dr. Shauna Levy, said to me. Mm-hmm. We don't know the long-term risks of these drugs, but we do know the long-term risks of obesity. And they are really bad, right? So again, you've got to go back to that weighing of the risks. And it's difficult. You have to keep using the word weighing all the time when you talk about this, which is unfortunate, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, this is mind-blowing. You see, having read the book, I still have more questions than, and you've gone to a huge amount of trouble to try and answer all the questions that may have come up. And you cite people's stories, their lived experiences throughout.
I actually hate the phrase lived experience because I always think, what's an unlived experience?
I hate it so much.
My lived experience.
You know what it is? It's such a lazy replacement for people who just don't bother to read or pay any attention to evidence. but if people's experience of this isn't something to go on, then I don't know what is, because it's still quite new. I'm still stuck. I still don't know. I haven't tried it yet myself. I may have to.
Are you thinking of it?
Yeah. I did. Last year, I very seriously considered it because someone I know has done it, and she's loving it. She's absolutely, life has improved. She's no longer preoccupied every waking hour with how fat she is. And she wasn't even that fat to begin with, if you ask me. I think it was mostly, as you say, psychological. But I think what you've done is you've gone to the trouble of paying inordinate attention to the detail, which you're doing the heavy lifting for us. I can't recommend it enough to people. I'm just going to put a picture of it up here, because if you're thinking about this, I mean, there's the audio book, there's the hardcover, softcover. You've got to get a look at this book, because it would help, if you are thinking about it, to inform yourself as well as possible. The chances are you may even know more than your doctor does when you go to them and say, can I get this stuff? And then getting it is a whole different story. But I'm just so grateful that you've done this, because the way you do things is you don't leave a lot of stones unturned. So I feel more informed now than I was. And I had so many questions. In fact, I spoke to a dietitian and a nutritionist and all of these people. And I had them on the show because there's so many people who listen to the show who also are thinking about doing this. And you try to find the best people, but we can't cover in an interview like this all the things that you've gone to discover in this book. It's really great. Are you sad that the adventure is over in terms of the book, because you're finding out new stuff now that relates to, I mean, you're going to have to bring out a second edition or a third edition? Or
it's interesting, the stuff that's coming out, we're learning new stuff every day, but it's reinforcing. I'd say the only stuff that we're discovering since it came out is more and more the extraordinary health benefits of them, right? So because I stress that so much in the book anyway, the health benefits of reversing obesity are just so staggering that it's sort of doubling down on stuff that I think the reader gets pretty clearly from the book anyway, fortunately. Obviously, you always worry with when you write about saying this, a kind of breaking news, you always worry, you know, oh Jesus, what if they discover the day before the book comes out that it really does give people horns or something? I've been pretty happy about that. I'm always sad when a book ends a little bit, but I've always got so many projects that I'm working on that I'm getting back to writing my book about Vegas, which I've been researching for 14 years, I think now. So I've got to finally write the damn thing. There are homeless people who live in the tunnels beneath Las Vegas who keep saying to me things like, Johan, have you still not written this book? And I'm just like, I'm being chided for my inactivity by people who, homeless people who live in a tunnel. This is not a good sign. I've got, that's my next one in the taxi rank that I've got to finish. I've written about half of it. But, yeah.
It's amazing stuff. I'm so glad I got to speak to you about this. I can't believe that it's already been almost an hour of us discussing it, and we've just scratched the surface. And well done for not being a fatso anymore. I mean, that must make you very pleased. were you on it already when I saw you last time?
No. Well, when did we? No, it was. It would have been. When was that? It was a year and a half ago. Yeah, I think I don't think I'd started taking it when we met. No, I don't. Well, I don't think so. It reminds me of when my niece was like 5 years old. She was drawing me and my mum, and she looked at me very tensely. She said, "Johan, you know when we draw adults, we just do a really big circle and a tiny face in the middle." And I said, "Yeah." She said, "That's not actually a good way of drawing people, is it? Because that's not actually what they look like." And I thought, "Oh, that's really good. She's learning about representation." I said, "No, Erin, that's really good. That's not what they look like." And she looked at me and said, "But the great thing about you is you actually do look like that. So it makes my picture really accurate." It was like, "You fucking bitch, you're out of my will now."
All right, listen, I love talking to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, and we'll cheers. Catch up. I'll see you in South Africa soon. Cheers.